So, hey, stop me if you've heard this one. So me and Kara, we were sitting in the living room and Kara asked me, hey, are you a vampire? I said, no. And she said, so you saw yourself in the reflection in the mirror and you still decided to show up like that? It's good stuff. Anyway.
Oh, gather round, you sailors bold, and hear the tale we sing of Dr. D and Scarlet Widow, who are the stormy rings. With clever hands and daring dreams, inventor of soup, held anchor's grasp. In every port, the legend grew, the tales unsurpassed.
Hello, Arachnids. This is your host, D to the D, Dr. D. We're reaching out through this poorly supervised Spanish main. Today, I'm joined by the newest member of the crew. His name's Miguel. Say hi, Miguel.
Hello.
Hello. Miguel here is also known as Blackest Caesar. Is that what it is? Or Blackish?
I believe it's Blackish Caesar. That's kind of like a play on the fact that I'm Hispanic, so, you know, sort of black, but not quite.
Sure.
That's my precursor to Summer Plunder. Some Plunder, I'm going to change it. I'm going to be the Blackest Caesar.
That's what they call a promotion. You got field promoted on your ism at the very end. I got a whole different kind of ism, but we'll get to that anyway. So today on Arachne, we're going to be talking about Adepticon, which is coming up here pretty soon. As of time of recording, it's a few weeks. So we're going to try and get this episode out a little bit quicker so it doesn't come out after. And yeah, we're going to talk about what we're excited about. But first, we got to talk about some business. On Arachne, we have to thank our patrons. They're the people that help keep the lights on and all that stuff. I'm definitely out of practice. I have fumbling all over my words all over the time. And we have to thank Cyril S., Derek S., Quimby, Nick B., and Aleph is the Way. I'm going to actually bump into at least Aleph is the Way at Adepticon because we're going to be playing some Blood Bowl together. Oh, isn't that fun? Yeah, so much fun. Arachne is a part of the Professional Casual Network. If you'd like to support the network, please sign up at our Patreon or purchase some hot swag at streamlabs.com, Professional Casual Network 1. I personally am sponsored by Monument Hobbies. We use their paints the most, probably out of all the various paint ranges out there. If you want to see me use them, you can always come to the Twitch, which we do every or most Sunday, Monday, and Thursdays, where we talk about painting and talk about just whatever, a lot of history. Talk about history a lot. And if you want to use a code to get yourself a discount, use the code Professional Casual at checkout. Get yourself a swanky little discount. We love Baron of Dice. They have the coolest dice in the biz. I use their dice pretty much exclusively for Blood and Plunder at this point. And use the code Arachne to get yourself a 5% discount. And of course, we can't forget our sponsor, Mr. Laser, MrLaser.SquareSite. We are going to be hopefully making some new tools for Blood and Plunder with another person around here who makes like widgets, I guess you could say. His name is Brian. I will hopefully have more details on that later. I don't think he has anything on his shop, but once he does, I will probably put him in here as a sponsor. He's a great guy and absolutely makes some beautiful tools. So hopefully he'll be on here more sooner than later, should I say. But anyway, yeah, so enough about that. We're actually going to get to the topic. Today, Miguel, you are finally here. You've hovered around the Blood and Plunder community from, I'm assuming, since the very inception. That seems to be the case.
I mean, I've been in it for a while. I was a backer of the original Kickstarter. I got to meet Mike at one of the Gen Cons that he attended very early, where he's showing off product. I got to see the initial Kickstarter models. I got to see a bunch of previews of like when they were first releasing the cavalry models. Those actually didn't come out in the original Kickstarter. Those were like, I think they were standalone, like blister release in between. But I got to see some of the ships and stuff very early before the Kickstarter was delivered. But I can kind of go into that story a little later since.
Sure. And obviously, whenever we have somebody new come on, we always like to have them tell us their nerd origin story. So you won't be any different. Please proceed, sir.
We have a lot of younger people on this show. My nerd story is long.
long and tumultuous.
I'm an avid listener, so I kind of know some of the previous ones. So I'll kind of skim through a lot of it. So I'm old enough that my earliest gaming introductions were things like Zork, which if you're not familiar with it, is a text-based, you literally typed in what you're going to do, like go north, go south, pick up this, pick up that, look over there. Like you would, and you know, there wasn't a lot of like instructions. It was like you had to kind of guess what instructions was actually coded into this thing. With that also came early video game kind of simulation games. I was always drawn to games that had, it was either simulation or kind of very early adventure, almost proto role-playing games. I liked games where there was a lot of simulation and a lot of progression. And adventure games tended to have that, like, hey, you had like actions you took and there were consequences or results that kind of went through your entire playthrough. As video games evolved, you know, it got more complex and more graphics kind of improved. I remember moving into like Bard's Tale, which is like a kind of a classic like dungeon crawler type game that had like three iterations.
Love Bard's Tale. Game's awesome.
I got into a really fun simulation. Submarine simulations were one of my big ones when I was growing up. And so there was one called Silent Service that had a couple of iterations, and I played that. Sid Meier's Pirates, but we'll get into that more later. So, but as I was growing up, you know, a lot of video games, a lot of like role-playing video games, tabletop, pen and paper role-playing games, not Dungeons and Dragons, oddly enough. I kind of was doing like Shadowrun and some of these more like Legend of the Five Rings, some of these games that were little.
Yeah, hell yeah. Hell yeah.
Yeah. I have an issue with games like I play Dungeons and Dragons. Dungeons and Dragons is great. But I tend to have a problem with games where resurrection is a mechanic. And my approach to a lot of those kind of games is actions should have consequences. And if you can just be resurrected from the ultimate consequence, then how invested are you really in the outcome of something? Like, I was known as a pretty, not harsh GM, because I never felt like the dynamic between a person running a game and a person playing the game should be adversarial. I'm not here. Sure. It's not me versus the players. I'm telling a story or trying to, I'm setting the parameters and my players are interacting with the environment and we're collaboratively telling the story. But if there's not the threat, if we're going to get into a combat and there's not a threat of somebody dying, then what are the stakes here? How important?
Yeah, it's where the tension.
Right. It's like, if you know you're going to win, it's just by how much you're going to win, then what's the point? I mean, you know, as skilled and powerful as the characters are in the Lord of the Rings series, there's not one like fight scene where like almost that somebody who's a major character isn't gravely affected by it, either killed, wounded, or something like that. So, you know, even these, and in that series, those characters are really larger than life. They're still characters who are killed or injured or suffer greatly as a result of those conflicts. And so that's kind of like an important story element. But moving on, I probably didn't get into miniature gaming until, I want to say like my 20s, when I really started getting to it. A little bit here and there. I'd pick up a thing here, pick up a game there, but nobody was playing it. Nobody in my friend group kind of knew what this was. Like, what are you going
to? Yeah, for sure.
You're going to paint plastic figures? How do you do that? I don't even know how do you do that. So I probably wasn't into my early 20s. I started getting into like Warzone and 40K. I rarely got to play because I was somebody who was like, I don't want to play my stuff just plastic. I want to paint it. And I got to a certain moderate level of proficiency with painting, it would take me 3 days to finish one figure because I was just one of those people that it had to be like done before I moved on.
And this is back in the day when models were like simple.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just like a guy standing there like in a T pose with like a gun and a sword.
Right. Like, I don't like the way my shoulder pads, the two-tone shoulder pads on my Space Marines, like, you know.
Sure.
Yeah. So, I remember, and this is where I kind of like started to kind of get the ugh about, you know, 40K. Not that 40K, great models. I'll still buy 40K models. But I remember I would start painting an army and that the addition I had built my army for and was painting for would go out of current. Like, two editions would pass, and I was still trying to paint my army. So, you know, at a certain point, I was just like, and then really kind of like, the last time I tried to get into 40K was 10th edition. And that's when, like, I think Primaris launched in and around that time.
Yeah.
And in some ways, I like that they wanted to, like, introduce this new scale and this sweeping changes to, like, the Space Marine line with a story. But I felt like the way they did it, it was a little ham-fisted. It was a little bit of an F you to people who had legacy armies. And there were things in the introduction of Primaris where it was so obvious a move to get you to just buy your entire Space Marine army again. Like, I was like, why? I mean, the Primaris are bigger than the regular Space Marines, but regular Space Marines couldn't go into a Primaris vehicle. And I was like, why? They should have more room than the Primaris. Like, oh no, they can't. They can't handle the it's built for Primaris spec. They can't handle it. They can't sit in the chair.
The seatbelt is too big. Right. It's a hazard to them.
I feel like might choke them. Space Marines just got a business class upgrade. They should be fine. They can have another.
Look at all those leg rooms. Yeah. So much room for activities.
Great. You know, so. I don't know. I mean, whatever. I mean, that's a longer conversation. It's not really pertinent, but, you know, so there was that. So fast forward, I've started getting into a lot of Kickstarter board game and RPG campaigns. It was when, like, if something came out on Kickstarter and you were moderately interested in it, you backed it. You backed it all the way. Everybody was backing Kickstarters and everybody was loving it. All these old games that nobody could get published, or were all of a sudden getting crowdfunded. And it was almost like this, like, nirvana of, like, all this old stuff, this niche stuff that, you know, maybe it's only like X amount of people in these areas would ever want to play this. But when you put it on social media and on this platform, all those people could converge and suddenly these projects could get funded. And so one of my favorite games when I was coming up was Sid Meier's Pirates. And it checked a lot of boxes for me. It was a simulation game. It was a war game, and it was a sea battle game. It had progression, a ton of progression. I mean, progression in your ship, your crew, your upgrades, your equipment, what you read, you kind of like, you know, rewrote history as to who was controlling the Spanish Main, depending on which faction you backed. And then, you know, when you maxed out your rank in one faction, you betrayed them and started fighting for their adversaries and ranked up with them and got tons of land and stuff from them. And it also had some RPG elements. There was a story built into, you know, especially Sid Meier's Pirates 2, where you had a whole backstory with recovering your family members. And you got, well, I got my sister and I got my, you know, my brother and all these other people. And then they each had a piece of a map for, like, some crazy amount of treasure that was buried. And, you know, so I got super into that game. Loved that game. To this day, I could load that game and play it.
It's one of the best games ever made. Yeah. Easily.
And I always was wondering, like, man, what if you could play this game, like, in a, you know, a bigger campaign? Like, because you always were ever reduced to, like, kind of like one ship when you got into a ship battle. Like, what if you can control a fleet? And there are kind of some RTS type games, and maybe Total War tried to do it with Empire and stuff, but there was never really a great multi-ship simulation or more detailed simulation type game. And fast forward many years, and, you know, all of a sudden there's this Kickstarter campaign for this miniature game called Blood and Plunder. And I'm like, this is literally everything that I ever wanted. This is great. And I was like, the figures look cool. I was like, are those boats in scale? And I was somebody who always, like, struggled with GW scale. I was like, 10 Space Marines fit in this thing? I don't, I don't think so. But whatever. So I look at this. It's like, man, that's a lot of figures on those decks. Is that the scale? Mm-hmm. And, you know, this was kind of like the beginning of where, like, certain Kickstarters were not kind of meeting their the expectations. So I was starting. There was a lot more doubt at this point. So I was like, all right, I'll back this, and if it's even close to what it's showing, I'll be happy.
Yeah.
And it was from the time that Kickstarter had ended, and a few months later, and I go to Gen Con, and you know, Firelock is there. So I go and I meet Mike Tunez. And one thing about Mike, Mike is extremely approachable. He is he is somebody who is very humble, very approachable. You could go up to Mike and within 5 minutes being talked to him, like he was just like one of somebody who was in your gaming group. He's extremely appreciative of the people who are fans of his game. He is very approachable, will talk to you, you know. And so Mike, I was like, and I remember going there and they had like a painted, fully painted frigate, fully painted sloop and a couple of the other ships. And I remember seeing them and I'm like, is that what I'm going to get? Because I had backed and I think I'd gotten one sloop and a frigate. And I remember, and some, I think like two longboats. And I remember looking at it and going, am I going to get that? And they're like, yeah, those are mock-ups of the ships. And they had these beautiful tables. They had these beautiful small like display tables that were like, you know, you ever see those sea tables where like it's kind of like a clear glue that they use to kind of create the water effect? They had these two beautiful tables that were like made like that. They got stolen. They had them like in this, like they had them in like this box truck or something in like whatever industrial park they were at the time. And typical Miami, somebody broke into it. So there's some like Methodonians with like some like triple A grade gaming tables out there. I don't know what they're doing on them, probably lines or cooking meth, but they have these tables out there. But they had these beautiful display tables. They had these beautiful miniatures. They showed off their cavalry models, which hadn't even been shown yet. I was like, this game is real. I'm actually going to get this stuff. And then eventually delivered. And it was, you couldn't believe how awesome it was. And then I just started.
All metal. It was all metal back then.
Yeah, too. It was all metal, all pewter figures.
Yep. Sure.
And then so I was at this point, I was in the police force and I'd been in it for a long time. I was making good money. And so I was like, I was trying to get my stuff painted. And I remember Rufus had like displayed some figures on like the Blood and Plunder Facebook page. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of reached out to him and said, hey, man, do you do the commissions? And he said, yes. And I said, oh, well, how much do you charge? And he had a reasonable rate. And I said, will you paint my stuff? And if I send it, he goes, yeah, sure, no problem. And I said, do you do the ships? Yeah, I'll paint up the ships. I think he had painted a lot of like the display stuff, at least for No Piece Beyond the Line. I don't know if he did the first iteration of it. But, you know, and so he painted a bunch of my stuff. And then we were going to go are you going to be at this event? I'll just go to this when I see, I think it was Historicon. I said, you want to just bring it and I'll just pick it up from there.
Sure.
And he said, yeah, cool. And there was some event that we were going to that Mike was going to be at. And he's like, hey, man, do you know Mike? I said, well, and you met him one time. He goes, oh, I'll introduce you to him. He's a very cool guy. And of course they had a conversation about that between the two of them. I know they were like, cause me and Rufus would chat a lot. And Mike says like, hey, is this guy going to be cool? And he's like, oh, this guy talks a lot of crap. He's always picking balls. And Mike was like, oh, good. Then he can hang. If he's going to be
sure,
he's got a good sense of humor, then we can mess around. And then, you know.
Now, it should be said that the Rufus we were talking about is the one that was on earlier, the creator of Blood and Bayonets, who came on, I guess, almost 6 months ago by this point. But
yes.
Yeah, same Rufus.
Yeah.
The small circle.
Another great
or tight knit.
It should be said another great game. Blood and Valor doesn't get enough. That isn't talked about enough. And what I'll say about Blood and Valor is before Blood and Valor, I couldn't give a shit about the Great War. I really couldn't. It just didn't, you know, never resonated with me. And now it resonates so much that I've read about it and watched various media about it. And I joined a whole Great War podcast series on YouTube. I couldn't give a shit about World War II.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? It's weird how it like overtakes it.
World War II is a very different war. But it is a war where, I mean, unless you're a really certain type of conspiracy theorist, it's it's a war where there's a fairly clear good and bad guy, where that's not the case in World War One. I mean, there's some good, there's some definite like atrocities in World War One, and even genocides, but, you know, it's a little more nuanced, you know, these aren't necessarily like Germany is not a big bad necessarily in that war. It's hard to say if they're almost, it's either everybody's got their own point of view or everybody's a bad guy, you know, however you want to look at it. But it really is in the beginning, really kind of like the last romantic war that, you know, basically devolves into what it is, you know, towards the end. So,
If nothing else, I think World War One was more about imperialism.
Yeah.
It's definitely a war of imperialism, if nothing else, because you figure the Kaiser, Germany, everybody, I guess, in some ways, think that like Germany in World War One and Two was like some kind of weird Nazi super rights wing, or I guess socialism's right wing. Fascism's right wing. This like incredible like right wing death camp producing thing. It's like in World War One they were trying to democratize. Like Prussia was desperately trying to become a democratic state, and the Kaiser was just like, nope, we're not letting it happen. World War One happens, and then they have a friggin' revolution like 2 weeks before the war ends. And they kick them out. It's very similar to the Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks that happened in World War. And like when you think about the series of events, I'm about to go on a real wild tangent. I'm going to wrap it up real fast. But if you think about like the things that happened in Russia and Germany and even like France in like the middle of the war, by the end of the war, those places are wildly different places. Like the entire earth shifted monumentally because we were shooting at each other with machine guns and everybody thinks trench warfare, but that's like obviously not the case. It's just it's a war that I think is wildly overshadowed by World War II, by the sequel. And I think that only recently it's been getting a little bit more attention, I think in other pieces of media or whatever. But if you're ever just like, you know, I just want to learn something today, learning anything about World War One, and I guarantee you it'll actually surprise you how much it resonates with what's still kind of happening today, in a lot of ways. It's very interesting.
I mean, you know, it's tough because, you know, not every nation had a great president like Woodrow Wilson to see them through to victory. That's an inside joke.
I absolutely hate you. I despise Woodrow Wilson. But anyway, please continue.
You know, but I mean, again, it's a game where, you know, Blood and Valor does not have the depth of like named characters and stuff of Blood and Plunder. Yet it captures the same type of like this very narrative style of war game where, you know, just by virtue of the design of the game, the rules of the game, the way that the forces are presented invests you in the game in a way that I think few do. Nothing is quite as good as Blood and Plunder in the Firelock series of games, I think.
Sure.
But of all of their, I haven't played a lot of Crowns, and it's not because I don't like Crowns. I mean, I think that if I got into Crowns, it might be my second favorite game in the Firelock series. Whereas right now it is Blood and Valor. The problem is, I couldn't give a flying fuck about the Hundred Years' War. And I love, I think it's Eric who designed that game. That guy who designed Blood and Crowns, a gem of a person, like just a wonderful human being. But I was like, can you please pick a conflict that I give a shit about? I mean, Crusades is kind of overplayed. I get it, but that's the kind of like conflict I want from that time period. And I think it's been suggested very loudly. In fact, I'm going to suggest it now that he do the Reconquista.
Which would be great. I was just about to say.
It's the Western Crusades. It's fantastic. Yep. you know, and it's a, one of the few periods where like, you know, Spain has it going on.
Yes, they do.
They do not have it going on in Blood and Plunder, despite
everything.
Yeah.
Post Napoleon. Well, actually, everything post Blood and Plunder. Yeah. Spain ain't got a whole lot. Ain't got a lot of gas in the tank.
It's as it's taking over all of the new world, it's still running out of gas. Even when it has, like, I forget what percentage of the world's gold flowing to it, they still found a way to, like, run a debt and squander it, you know, so.
I will say, so you're not a huge fan of the Agincourt mud fun run? What are you talking about, man? It's one of the best parts of human history.
Here's how current Blood and Crowns go for me.
He's gonna teach me.
England and France are fighting again.
Forever.
And during a time where, like, England is in France. Like, they own territory in France. These two empires are as intertwined as you could possibly be.
Because it was Bordeaux and Aquitaine. I think we're both English kingdoms, technically. In France. All right, we're going way off topic. Anyway, you know where you can play that game?
Hey, Adeptica. Watch this.
Yeah.
Who cares?
Me.
Who cares?
I care.
Okay.
Who cares? Kara cares because she's going to have to edit this thing.
Great system, Blood and Crown.
Yeah, it
great
is. System. I love this. I love the idea.
They have one thing in the initiative system that I don't like, but it's easily ignored. But great system. Wonderful creator. Tons of potential. I can't wait to see what he does with it next. I've heard what he's doing with it next, and I don't like it. Go back to Spain. Eric, listen to me. Anyway.
So anyway, if you want to influence Eric, what you do is you go to Adepticon, and you look for him. I don't know who it is. I don't know what he looks like. Okay. I don't even know if he'll be there.
Eric has real responsibilities and a family. He is not going to Adepticon until Gross. His kids get older, and then he can kind of leave them behind.
He'd abandon them at home,
right.
Tie them to the radiator, and then it won't cause any problems. So anyway, that leads into the next part of this entire conversation. So what is Adepticon? If you have no idea what Adepticon is by this point, then you're either new to the hobby or you have gone out of the way to not learn about the greater part of the hobby. Adepticon is, in my opinion, and to the opinion of a lot of the people I know, the best 4 days in gaming. Which is, it was in Schaumburg, which was in Illinois, very close to, it was a suburb of Chicago, and it stayed there for a while. It was in Indianapolis or something before that. It was like in another spot. I don't exactly remember where it was before Chicago, but it's moved as it's gotten bigger. It was in Chicago for the longest. Most people associate it with Chicago, which is where it was before. And as of last year, it moved to a new location, which is in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And if you have seen the differences between the old place and the new place, I do believe, is better in that it's bigger. Milwaukee is a fun city. The food there was really good. But if you really had to sum up what Milwaukee is, or well, not Milwaukee, but Adepticon, it's a very big collection and get together. And in my opinion, it is the best miniatures gaming focused nerd convention on the planet Earth. There are a lot of other great conventions. There's Gen Con. There's Spiel. That's more of a board game. Gen Con is more of like a kind of pan nerd board game miniatures gaming one. That one's a little bit more wide reaching. And then you have your other smaller ones like Historicon and Recon and all that stuff where it's mostly just like very focused in on a very specific topic. But I think if you are interested in painting or playing or enjoying the hobby of miniatures gaming specifically, I think Adepticon is where it's at because it's where the main focus of the con is. And I definitely think it's the best con out there for that thing. Would you agree?
So my con that I've most frequented is Gen Con. I've been to Gen Con back when it was still in Milwaukee. Oddly enough, where Adepticon is now is what used to be what used to host Gen Con before it outgrew Milwaukee. It's kind of outgrown Indianapolis. The last time I attempted to go to Gen Con, by the time we got to pick a hotel, our hotel was 12 miles away from the convention center. Now, I want to give you some context. 12 miles away from the convention center means when you land at Indianapolis International, you drive away from Indianapolis. You drive away from the city, away from the convention center for about 4 miles. And that's where you check into your hotel because the city is only, I think, 8 miles from the airport.
Yeah. Yep.
So Gen Con's great. A lot of fun. Great food in Indianapolis. Indianapolis begrudgingly has accepted Gen Con because it just brings in so much money. I went there early on, and I got to be honest with you. If you've ever gotten stuck because of flights or something being canceled in Indianapolis about 5 minutes after Gen Con closes, it's got
it's like, a little different.
It's got like Colts fans and maybe some Indy 500 gift shops, and that's it. There's a begrudging acceptance of it while it's while Gen Con's going on. But they quickly revert back to a little more routine after it closes down. So, Milwaukee has always been a little bit nerdier a town. I think was Midwinter or some other type of convention there. There's like a weird convention that takes place, I think, in like January, which was meant to kind of like fill in for when Gen Con left Milwaukee, and they couldn't schedule anywhere near the summertime because there are all these other conventions going on. So I think Midwinter or another convention in that time span is in Milwaukee during that. It's super cold in Milwaukee at that time. So,
sure. We have Everwinter up here in the Northeast. So if you're interested in that kind of stuff, come to Everwinter in Boston in the January, December. Because, yeah, this one is January 8th to the 11th, as it was this year.
Yeah. So Milwaukee's much more of a nerdier town. It is a good – it's good in that – in Schaumburg, you could not walk to places to eat. That was not a thing. I did it, and that was – but it was a hike. In Milwaukee, you can. It's much closer to, like, Indianapolis in that there's a downtown area. You can walk to stuff. So it's more friendly in that respect. I've been to Milwaukee probably – it's been a long time, but I probably went to Milwaukee for like 10 times for Gen Con before they moved. It'll be a fun time. Adepticon. It is a great con and probably the best con for miniature gaming. I don't know if it's the best con for historical miniature gaming. I think historical is a much smaller part of that convention than more, you know, modern sci-fi or fantasy miniature gaming. But it's decent for it. And to give people, if you guys haven't been to any big conventions, to give you some perspective, and this is the most honest opinion of like who is the best con, you will not get the same concentration of miniature gaming at Gen Con that you will at Adepticon. But let's be clear, you could fit, at least the last time that I was at Adepticon, which may be like 2 or 3 years ago, you could have fit the entire convention of Adepticon in the vendor hall of Gen Con. That is not a joke.
Gen Con is huge.
The vendor hall of Gen Con is enormous. And all the vendors, or most of the vendors in Gen Con, are the people who created the games. So if you want to meet the person who designed your board game, there's a good chance they themselves will be at Gen Con trying to sell their game to you, no matter how big the game is. It's really almost like a trade show and a con together, you know. So there's that aspect of Gen Con. Adepticon gets a lot of that too now, but again, it's limited to miniature gaming.
And that's why Mike's there.
Mike's barely.
Make sure he shows up for that one. Yeah. So yeah, Adepticon, absolutely recommend going there. I know a lot of the upper people in it now, and I gotta say they're all really, really good people. It's definitely not a convention that has its like head up its own butt. Like, they do it because they actually really enjoy the fact that they can get people to like come together and make like this community. There is no ulterior motives from the higher ups on it. I guarantee you. Having heard how it kind of how the sausage is made a little bit in the background, they very much have your interest in mind. There is no the amount of work they put into doing stuff for the con is staggering. So if you go there, it absolutely bleeds good vibes. It's a fantastic time. Highly recommend it. If it's your first con, it makes a great first con, in my opinion, just because everybody there is very friendly. And I've bumped into people from all over the world. So highly recommend it. Even if you go there and do nothing, you'll have tons to do. It's the wildest thing.
If you go there, if you're just a hobbyist, because there are people who are into miniatures that are not necessarily the sweatiest gamers or the most competitive gamers. There's some people who are really just here to hone their artistic craft. And for those people, if you don't want to play any games, if you want to just go there to hang and shop, but you want to hone your craft, Adepticon, Gen Con as well, but certainly at Adepticon, which is kind of focused, you know, painting and painting technique and miniature gaming go hand in hand. So for the most part, there are some games that have good pre-painted models, but those are rare. Most of them, you're going to paint them. And so if you wanted to take like a really high-end, painting course or modeling course and really sit at the feet of some of the really the most talented artists that are in that industry, Adepticon is definitely a place where you will run into those people. They're giving you small classes, very reasonably priced. I mean, some of them are as cheap as like $280, and you get a very small class with a person who's like going to give you some really hands-on technique. Like, hey, you might think your dry brushing is good, but then when you are with the dry brush master, it's going to elevate your game to another level.
Appreciate you saying that. Anyway, so as far as we – so I'm going to go out on a really weird – and it's not really a tangent, but a quick aside. I have one complaint about Adepticon, and that is something that isn't really in their control, but I – like you kind of alluded to it earlier with the historical aspect of it. I do believe that
you haven't won
the
that
area
– Oh, sorry. I didn't mean to say it. I said a lot.
I have comments about that. I have technically sort of won a Best Painted at Adepticon, technically speaking, but there might have been a name switch. It doesn't matter. Anyway, so the biggest complaint I have is that the historical area is very much kind of tucked into a weird corner in that it's in that third floor that you have to really kind of like know where it is. It's very difficult place to have newcomers who just might be happening to like walk by. I guess you haven't seen it, right? Yeah, because you didn't go last year. So yeah, it's very out of the way. It's very up an escalator, up another escalator, up another escalator, and you can only know it's there is if you were actually looking for the area. So I think it'd be almost impossible to just kind of randomly stumble upon the historical area, which I think does. Not to say that it's not fair or whatever, because I do think that the other model games that are at Adepticon probably are a little bit bigger than most of the historical games. I mean, if you ask somebody who's been in the hobby, hey, have you heard of 40K or have you heard of Blood Red Skies? They probably know a little bit more about 40K than Blood Red Skies. So Blood Red Skies is a plain game to anybody who doesn't know what that is. And so I think, unfortunately, they are kind of caught in a catch-22 in that. I'm sure they would love to give the historical area more space and be a little bit more viewable, but when you have big titans in the industry like Asmodee and GW and to smaller then even just like Blacksite Studios, it's like they're probably bigger than Firelock is technically, like TT Combat and all that, like they get their space, and then triage it pretty well. But I do think that the historical games suffer because of that. It's not that it's bad. It's just that it's harder to get new blood if people don't just randomly walk by and see it. So that's my one complaint. I don't think anybody could do anything to fix it. It's not anybody's fault. I think it's just kind of a symptom of the situation.
I mean,
which you don't see this.
There's some yin and yang on that. Like, hey, listen, the more popular a game gets, yeah, it'll get more FaceTime, more players. It'll grow the hobby. It'll grow that particular brand. But you are going to get, a few more, rules as you know, written versus rules as intended types. And, you know, I mean, nature of the beast, things happen. People have very literal interpretations of rules. And then sometimes they cry about it during a tournament and people accommodate them because nobody likes to see a grown man cry. But, you know, it does make it for everybody else who's an adult or, you know, at least a rational person, it does kind of can ruin the experience for them. Now, fortunately, I'm pretty good at dealing it with people like that because I would just tell them, you know, nobody fucking plays it like that and we're not going to play it like that right now. But not everybody is really able to advocate for themselves. And if you have somebody who's just a real, you know, but I built my whole strategy around this. You know, sometimes there is the propensity to like kind of like take the path of least resistance with those people.
Yeah, social bidding. It's a whole thing. The social bid.
My soul died many years ago, and so you know, I don't know.
Is that all that's holding you back? The remnants of that soul stopping you from becoming the Blackest Caesar? Is that why you're only Blackish as of now?
Is it rotting out of your ear? Will probably change my screen name about 20 minutes before the tournament starts.
No.
20 minutes before the tournament starts, I will stop speaking to people in that tournament that I've known for years.
I am no longer the man you do. I am the artist formerly known as Blackest Caesar.
You know, if I am friendly to them, there will be a tone. They'll ask me if I'm okay. Something happen. No, man, I'm good. And then as soon as the game is over, there'll be hugs and kisses. But, you know,
sure.
In tournament, I have to destroy the people I love. They have to die. Yeah. That's not entirely there's a story behind this. I went to a convention in Pennsylvania called Historicon. And I really got into this game not to be competitive. I like to like fun, stupid lists. Maybe like really focus on like a particular like rule combo, just have fun with it, right?
And then you found Greylock.
That's still a suboptimal list. It really is.
Suboptimal.
But so I go and I play these stupid lists. I go to this convention. I go 0-9. I go like 0-3 and across three different like tournaments. At one point, like a 12-year-old beat me. In Blood and Valor Vault. I was like, do you even know what this war is? Why? Like, are you aware this war happened? Whatever. Because when I was 12, I didn't know anything about World War I. I was like, why do you? So 0-3, but at some point I'm owning it. I'm just like, 0-9, baby. People are laughing. You know, I'm not taking it seriously,
yep.
Whatever.
Yep.
Until Monday.
Oh, you told me this. I didn't know what's coming.
Monday, somebody made a quip in the Discord about that Nigel. Well, Nigel just sucks. It was the gist of it. I didn't mean to comment like, oh, well, it's not like I'm Nigel. You know, some quip. And I was like, oh, okay.
Ah, hell nah.
And then I showed up at the next big convention out of that, which was the Adepticon that I went to. And I was like, I don't even want to talk to you people. I'm sorry. I have to destroy everyone. At some point, I got paired up with like a first-time player in the second round of the tournament. And I just turn two. Match is over. Joe yelled. He's like, oh, thanks, Nigel, for freaking crushing that dude. And it was his first time. I was like, don't put me in the tournament with that guy. I'm not here to make friends. I'm here to, this guy's got to get destroyed. They talk about me in the Discord. They can't talk about me in the Discord again. I got to crush them. Sorry. I can't have that happen. People know me.
So anyway, actually, that's a good headway into the final topic, or the main meat of it. At least I thought it was going to be, which is things that are coming up with our Adepticon. So we're somewhat coordinated on the things that we're doing. Like, what are the events that we're going to do? I think the ones that we have overlap on are the sea tournament, the land tournament. Both of me and you are doing the Lake Maracaibo event. I think we're doing that one. Right. And then Treasure Island?
Maybe. I think so. There's one where I think I have to bring a list.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that was the it's not the Treasure Island one, but it's like there's something that's like
King of the Hill.
Just like it.
There's a King of the Hill.
It might be the King of the Hill. It might be the King of the Hill one. I think I'm also signed up for that one.
Yeah.
So I think all of us are doing that one. And then the only thing I'm doing that isn't with you somewhere around is I'm doing Blood Bowl Sevens. And I think that's it.
Oh, you signed up for that crazy doubles thing. And I'm like,
I'm in the Firelock land doubles event thing.
I was fine with that when it was going to be like one game that we all played. And then they made it into like a secret tournament. And I was like, hey, is there going to be a little skull on like a ribbon that I win for this? No, I need to be well rested. People know me in the Discord. I can't get wrecked because I was tired playing with you guys at an overtime. No. Nigel is old. I need sleep and I need breakfast and real food. I cannot live on convention center food. I need to take a break and get real food, come back, be energized to wreck your lives in this tournament. So I can't be woozy because I stayed up for bragging rights. That's not, you know. And I'm not even like a super competitive, like, oh, I got to win this. But I need to have legitimate fodder to talk shit to people. I need to be like, hey, remember when I just wrecked you in that tournament? It's like, oh, that's a funny comment. Remember when I just destroyed you and disproved all your theories in that tournament? So I need that. I can't be in that doubles tournament.
People only have good thoughts about you, I'm sure, by the end of it.
I have enough friends. I don't need good thoughts.
Okay. I don't need more.
Okay. Every 6 months, I clip a few. Every 6 months, I clip a few people. That I'm like, why am I even associated with you? I haven't talked to you in a year. Snip.
Just pruning. You're just pruning. It's fine. Everything's fine. So, okay. Well, if that leads to, oh, then you were doing like a couple other things that weren't Firelock related, I think.
What am I doing?
Something about Halo. Did I see Halo in that thing?
What?
I don't know. It might have been one of your friends. I think one of your friends is playing like a Halo game. One of my friends is playing Halo.
Well, those people need to grow up. But, you know.
You need to prune them next.
Right. I mean, whatever, man. They almost got pruned this week. I almost pruned their whole Discord. You know, whatever, man. Those guys are they're really into Corvus Belli, which, I mean, I like Infinity. But it is a game that I could not be super competitive in. If they want to say it's my lack of ability, whatever the case would be, there's too much going on for it for me to get too sweaty in that game. And I don't think it has a certain elegance to it with what it tries to do. But I think that when you get ultra competitive with it, I think that community at its highest level, and again, this can be regional, it can be situational, but I feel like the most competitive aspect of that game is a little less attractive for me than
others. I tend to agree.
Yes.
Ultimately, it's one of the reasons why I don't enjoy the game quite as much as I used to.
If you and I played that game, beer and pretzels, you're joking around, I can't believe you hacked my tag, stuff like that.
Yeah, right.
And it'd be fun. But, you know, if it got super sweaty, I don't know if I could really care. I feel that way about like BattleTech Alpha Strike a little bit, where I'm like, this isn't the best rule set, but it's BattleTech. It's very old. It's like a nostalgic game. I'm happy to play it. It's beer and pretzels with my friends, but it's not a game that I can get super sweaty about. But there's some grognards that do, and you know, it makes it less fun, at least for me.
I have to tend to agree with you on that one, and I will say, I have made some amazing friends in the community, but in the Infinity community, I will say that, yeah, not you. You're not a part of that community. I will say that, unfortunately, in regards to Infinity, there is a third component of the game that I think gets often overlooked and can very much control your enjoyment of the game, which is very much the board. Like, if you were to show up in a game of Fire or any of the Firelock games, for the most part, like, I'm sure there are bad boards, but the wild swing of you having a good time and you having a really bad time is significantly less volatile in a fire in like a game like Blood and Plunder is a good example. Like with Infinity, if you walk up to a bad table and you don't have a list that can just maneuver on it in any way that is highly competitive, because you're going to be going up against people with other cutthroat lists, you're just going to lose and it's going to feel awful. And then you're going to sit there and watch everything die really slowly, usually, unless you're lucky.
There's a minutia to the action economy in Infinity that is way more predictable and kind of like, you know, important part of the game than in Blood and Plunder. Blood and Plunder action economy is important. And there are people who have math hammered Blood and Plunder and like, hey, if you have inexperienced, trained, veteran guys, what's the optimal action economy? But it's always predictive, right? Because there's a random element to how many actions you're going to get depending on the cards you draw and the experience level of the guys who fielded. Infinity is much more fixed. You have the actions that your guys generate per round, and the only variance is how many guys get killed, which then reduces the number of actions that you have generated in that turn. And it's only three turns. So, hey, if you made a list and it's 12 actions, well, we know you have maximum of like, you know, around 36 actions. There are models that get extra actions, so it could be variance a little bit, but you're in that 36 to 40 actions for the rest of the game until you start losing models, and then it's going to reduce. So it is a game where, like, having the meta is to have as many actions as you can. And that leads to you taking some, and there's really, really cool models in Infinity. Cool special characters, cool, even just units that have all kinds of cool skills and gear and stuff like that. But if you want to play the meta of competitive Infinity and you want to get to the maximum of 15 actions, you got to take some dog shit guys. In fact, some of the optimal lists have full fire teams of five dog shit guys to generate my maximum of 15 actions. And then, but there's no actions assigned to a particular unit. So I could take all 15 of those actions and put them on the three guys that actually matter on this list where I have 15 actions, but they all go to these three guys. And that is a really not, to me, not a great system for force building. You know, there should be some sort of limits. Like, I understand if you want to say that every model could take, you know, five orders per turn. That seems pretty generous when you, the maximum orders you can have is 15. But in Infinity, you could put all 15 on a guy if he keeps it rolling.
And it's interesting you say that, because there's been another game that's recently popped up called Eldfall Chronicles, which is very much just Fantasy Infinity from the looks of it. And it actually has limitations like that, where you can only give a certain amount of orders to a guy who runs up and does whatever, or magic or whatever.
I haven't delved super deep into the rules for Eldfall, although they are publicly available. But what I've seen in the reviews of it, it has the limitations that I would want to see in Infinity. But again, I'm not trying to hawk on Infinity. If you're playing with friends or a local league and it's not that sweaty, you can have a lot of fun with Infinity. It's a very deep game, very intricate. It's really like a wargaming RPG on some level.
It's a masterpiece in that regard.
Yeah.
Like, I have no shade at Infinity.
Yeah, I almost wish it had a progression system or a campaign system. It probably does, and I just not aware of it.
Yeah, I was just about to say it kind of does.
Yeah, you know, I wish it had something like that. The Cyberpunk miniature games, which I don't think is necessarily anywhere near as good a game, but it has more of that RPG element the way the game is kind of like set up.
Yeah, you know, I agree. And I actually have a segment for it on Arachne, which I'm sure you're somewhat vaguely aware of, where we talk about their game quite a bit. And we've had the creator of the game come on, and he says that, you know, that is a main factor of it, is, you know, you are trying to tell this like goofy story where the serial killer is punching a prostitute who's a hacker who's doing a drug run for a somebody, and they're, you know, blah blah blah, like that kind of customization in that regard makes the game wildly unbalanced in a lot of ways, I think. But it does very much hinge on the people you're playing with, where if you're like, hey, we're gonna tell some just goofy ass thing where the cops got stranded in the middle of the combat zone and they got attacked by a bunch of drug addicts, you know, it's like, that's a great game to do that with and have a, you know, just a roar romping time. But it comes down to, and I think that Adepticon is actually kind of going back to the topic, is a really good place to do these kinds of things, because you have people who bring games on the wide scale of, this is a game where you're just goofing off with your buddies. And then you have it on the other side, which is we have a game that is designed to be cutthroat, and we try to make it as balanced as possible, and so that every decision is a, you know, knife's edge, blah, blah, blah kind of thing. And I think a good gaming convention like this is a great opportunity to meet other people who might like the game you like or whatever. And, you know, you can build, you know, buy models and share in that joy with those other people. And I've always said this, and it's one of the reasons I fell into the game as hard as I have. I do think that while it's not perfect, Blood and Plunder is pretty close to what I would consider pretty balanced. There's nothing in it that's like super egregiously bad, that's like wildly available to all the factions or whatever. I'm sure there are things that stand out. Ostland privateers are kind of insane, in my opinion. Don't know why nobody talks about that as much as they don't.
I just look at those guys. Not that good. They're not that
good. Ruthless Dutch. Ruthless Dutch.
They're not that good. They're not that good. There's better Dutch factions, okay? There's better Dutch factions, all right?
Well, it's not a Dutch faction. It's a Spanish faction. What are you, stupid?
Whatever.
What are you, stupid?
Hey. You know what? You know what? Why don't we take away some Dutch factions and give them to the Spanish? That's what I think of that, okay? All right? You know, you and I, we've been talking list building quite a bit. Yep. I said, you'll never give up Ruthless now that you have it in a thing. You're like, oh, I don't really think Ruthless is a big deal. And that's when I knew
that's not what I said, but okay.
You were like, I could do without it. You were very flippant about
that's
it.
That's what I said.
You were very flippant. I'm going to put my finger in the camera. You were very flippant about Ruthless.
I was stoic about it.
And here's what's going to happen. This convention, okay, it's going to trigger a lot for you, because you're going to wake up and play that list the way you're supposed to. And you're going to – and you're going to wake up. Not the first day. Maybe the first day you'll wake up, because the rest of the time you're going to be exhausted
from
that stupid doubles convention. But that tournament, that's ridiculous. But you're going to wake up and it's going to trigger. And you're going to be like, holy crap. How have I lived without Ruthless in this game? And you're going to be like, I can never not have Ruthless. And you're going to play some lists that don't have Ruthless. And you're like, what is this list missing? Oh, Ruthless. I feel naked because I don't have Ruthless. Okay.
There's not a ton of it in English. Okay? That's the thing. It's really not really available.
Right. You're never going back to English. That's done. You might as well. That's over. English? Mm-hmm. Get out. That's done. Okay. You better just use them as pirate models. It's over. So you're going to super be like, I love Ruthless. I love it. I love it. I love it. Then one day you're going to be looking at Dutch generic commanders, and you're going to realize that Dutch generic commanders have Ruthless and Strict.
Yes, they do.
Accessible to them. And you're going to be like, I don't understand why Dutch are complaining. And then you'll join the rest of us. Whenever anybody who's like super into Dutch says one fucking thing, like, we wish we had more factions. We wish we had more this. We wish we had more content. Shut up. You want content? You get all the shitty lists that everybody else has. Everybody else has chaff. Everybody else has tons of chaff lists.
I can agree with
that. Native have chaff lists. Pirates have Pirates might be a chaff list.
You know what? Dutch need New England Village Garrison. The list. That's what they need right there. That's some hot firepower right there.
They need clog wearing civilian faction. I don't know what they think they're going to get. They need a faction of Amish. Okay, they're 1-point models, and you have to kill them all to win. I don't know what they need, but and look, I get it. You start getting very samey stuff. Yeah. You want maybe a little variety. I get it. Most people would play just another nation. They'd get over themselves, and whenever they wanted to win, they would just play Dutch. But not the Dutch players. They've been winning so long, they would have an opportunity to lose. I don't need to tell them. But I tell you what, there's tons of Dutch stuff that I'm sure is coming. And it is, every night I get down on my knees and I pray to our good Catholic Lord that the Dutch get all the factions they've been asking for and none of them are good. For all the extra factions that they get, all they play are
Dutch Navy,
Dutch Caribbean Militia, and Dutch Navy. Despite having 50 more factions, it's so weird. All we get is Vrij and Dutch Navy. It's so crazy.
Well, they're about to get a new captain, Captain Yella, which is also
doesn't British. He sail for England?
Yeah, he does both. He's going to be playable in Dutch
Navy?
I don't think it's that. Please tell me it's Navy. I think it's Privateers, I think.
Same shit.
I think. Well, Privateers are definitely, I don't think, as good as Navy. I mean, just having heavily built on your boat, it's just like, yeah, I'll take that 100%. Yeah, it's hard to beat for sure. But anyway, yeah, so we're just talking, God knows what we're talking about next. Anyway, so yeah, one last thing that I think we should go over is we're going to be playing in the Firelock events. You don't have to go over super incredible details or whatever, just in case you want to keep some of it hidden. But the list we brought, I figured we would kind of go over them real quick, or at least I will mine, because I don't really care if people build their list against me, I guess. I did decide that I was going to bring French this year. I have a lot of British English, more English, I guess, royalty in my blood, which is why I've always wanted to play England for this game. But I've come to the conclusion that...
I mean, why don't we tell the real story? Why don't we tell the real story about how you vacillated on playing French after you said, oh, I'm totally playing French. I don't know why I was playing English this long. I
had a moment of weakness.
Here's what you did. You had a panic attack about finishing painting your French. That is what you did.
I'm still panicking.
All right. Stop playing bad Cthulhu games and figures.
I need a break. Listen, you know how long I sit here slaving over this paint table?
I don't know what to tell
you. It's going
to
be fine.
You have time.
It's going to be fine.
And you did this to yourself because you could have just taken those stupid sea dogs and said, these are Marines.
You've
been fine.
That's the plan.
But you're like, no, man, I need to play the right nationality models. And I can't, my English can't be French. So I got some weird OCD nonsense. Shut up. Double up on your medication and bring the models you have painted.
I actually don't have enough painted sailors for the DeGraff list. So I actually do have to paint more sailors, even with all the sailors I have painted. Because when I'm playing British or English, what I do is I bring Henry Morgan, and he takes up a third of the list with his big fat butt. You don't need as many models. And all the freebooters cost 6 friggin' points.
He's so suboptimal.
Listen, I'm a huge fan of Henry Morgan as a person in history, and I love his story and all that. And I like using him in this game because it's funny. But the more I've played other stuff, by God, is he not good? He's not good.
You just hurt Joseph Forster's soul.
I know, and I love Joe. I know I did. But then I played DeGraff, who's the same amount of points, and I'm like, this guy is literally even Francois Lodonet. You're just like, this guy is insane. compared
to Sailor, DeGraff is almost a perfect captain.
Yeah. He's great.
Yeah. Dutch have like two 30 point, like perfect, just perfect commanders.
Yep.
And I can't wait for them to come out with some really shitty commanders for them, just so they can feel like they're involved.
Sure. You mean a model like Edmund Cook, where it's like a 10 point captain who has that's poor leadership?
That's like I don't know, a Dutch captain who was dropped, you know, in, as a toddler. I don't know what they want. I don't know what they want. Okay, I don't know what they want.
He has an agenda, as you can tell. Miguel might have an agenda.
I like the Dutch; they're a great faction. I don't. I'm confused as to why. You know, it's like a Space Marine player complaining that their force is too good. It's like, well, just play orcs. I don't know what to tell you. I mean, you know,
it's weird. Don't everybody write your hate mail to him, not me.
Bring it. Dutch, but bring it at the tournament. Please, bring it at the tournament.
I don't know if you're ever going to play somebody playing a land Dutch list. Is it going to happen? Does that even happen?
Yeah, it's called Vreesh. It's called Dutch Caribbean Militia. The best militia in the game.
That the I wouldn't best, argue.
The best that militia not, will, in the game.
We'll not argue that for a second.
You know, like, I don't know what to tell them. Like, are they confused?
Going on? Are they confused? If you're watching the video of this, it's the face he made.
I don't understand. Are they confused? What do they want? You know, you could do a Dutch Caribbean militia and just take four units of Vrij, fucking cold-blooded strict commander, or cold-blooded, if you want to get morale, I guess you could take, I don't know, inspiring, you loser, whatever. They're good. You know, take three of them and take a veteran unit of warriors just to send them in to smash people and finish them off. I don't understand. I'm confused. I came up playing natives where, like, having anything lower than a 6 morale was a privilege. You either had to take underaged warriors, you had to take young warriors who were suicidal, and that's why they had a 5 morale, or you had to take one of the most expensive units in the game, the Nisus, and they had 5 morale.
That's because natives don't like dying where they're standing. You know, they like the hit and run tactics. They don't want to stand and die, stand and deliver.
It was more fun to play natives when people didn't have good melee saves.
I could imagine.
I slammed into a unit of Vrij and they lived. They stood there and they were like, we're going to fight now. It's like, oh no, you're supposed to leave. You're not supposed to, you're supposed to go home. That's it. You're not like other militia, right? Other militia, when I hit them, they go away. They evaporate. Yeah. You know? Yes, they do.
English militia are weirdly stubborn in melee, but yeah, I do agree with you. Anyway, either way, but. I'll go over my list real quick. We're getting close on time, but I will say these lists were made mostly by my friend here, Miguel. I think I'm going to do a little bit of an altercation on my land list just to try it out before I submit the list. But it's just as likely that I go right back to where it was. But the C list, we're going to be doing a Frost. We're going to be Philibusier de Graf. So we're going to have Laurens. We're going to have Marins. A lot of Marins. We're going to have 3 units of them, 2 of them with their pistols taken away. There's a 12-man unit, an 8-man unit, and a 9-man unit that'll be manning the sheets. And then Marins Bosque. I will say the Marins Bosque, I did try them. I just tried this list yesterday. And I thought they were a little – they were whelming was my general interpretation of it. Like, they're shooting. They start at 7, so they're kind of – they're, you know, fine, whatever. But it's almost – because you're essentially taking them for the shoot save, right? That's the majority of the reason you take the Marin's Boss, because you get that 6 shoot save, as well as the pretty decent resolve, that is. But they're also really good at melee if you, you know, with their pistol. So in this case, we're just giving them regular pistols. We're going to downgrade them to train, yada, yada, just to save some points. But I don't know. I can feel the pull of just having Philibusiers in that spot, even though you might lose a few sailors, even though they're pretty much the same price. I can kind of see it go both ways. I think they're both great units. The Marin's Boss, I think probably better for durability just because you're not relying on that usual French shoot save of seven on anything that isn't a hillbilly. So
did
it's like
keep them with veteran?
I think we did. I think we did go them with veterans.
So veterancy can matter.
No, for sure.
They're there to really kind of they are an all-rounder. They are there to kind of like absorb the hits. I believe they're in the same section as like your three pairs of cannons, correct?
So that was something I was wondering about is the Lorenz unit. Where would you put Lorenz?
I'd have to see where he fits.
Right. That was what I was having trouble with.
This is a cannon ship because you're a gentleman. You're not an animal.
Correct.
I don't want to name names.
Pinkies Dan, up.
You know who you are, Dan. You're not taking like a bunch of just musketeers on a boat and just, you know, taking pot shots like it's, you know, an inner city, you know, housing development on the 4th of July. So, you know, you're here to, you know, you're here to like, you know, have a gentlemanly battle where we're shooting cannons and, you know, if we get a little savage, we'll shoot some grape shop up close. And then we're going to board and we're going to have a normal master and commander type of day. That's right. So in that respect, you're trying to protect your cannons. Now, are you should be completely relying on your cannons? No, that list can do boarding actions just as good as anybody. It's a very versatile list. It's not very focused.
Yes, I agree.
There are better shooters than the Marin's Basque, but I think as an overall unit that can do anything, it's pretty good. When you have those units that can do anything at sea, they tend to not have the six base shoot. Is what it is. Same thing for the Vizcaínos. Same thing for, I think, even the the able seamen, the British regulars of the sea, if you will.
Because they start at seven, too, I believe. I think they all do.
They're like a four morale. They're a four morale. Yeah. They're criminally hard to kill.
Yes, they are.
They are.
So yeah, shoot save six with a four, but yeah, I think their melee save is also five, six. I think it's also six. I think the melee save.
They're not a fun time to face.
No, they're not. Yeah. I was a little taken aback by their price at first when I first saw them. I was like, ooh, 6 points. That's a little steep for a sailor. And then I used them and I was like, my God, I'm unstoppable.
When you just save six resolve dice, you just go, oh, I don't even care about that's not really my concern.
I will say when you're playing the hillbilly list and you get shot at and you're like, okay, I'll save on fives and just roll it. And you're like, yep, this game's easy. This game's for babies.
Except that most of the hillbilly list saves on sixes.
Well, they all have elusive, you silly.
Huh?
They have elusive.
Not for morale.
No, I know that, but I'm saying when you're taking the hits from the bullets.
Oh, yeah, they're, you know.
Which helps your morale, because hopefully you're not losing people as much as you could be. So we're burying the lead here. So, yeah, anyway, to wrap it up, it also comes with a merchant frigate with no upgrades, medium cannons, all five, three in the middle, two in the back, and the chain shot, grape shot, and the master gunner. Yeah, so that was ultimately my decision point was where do you put the DeGraf, because I was putting – Because that does seem to be the key there is you do want the Marin's Basque and where the main cannons are just to absorb bullets. But then you have this like kind of like when you're doing the sheets and shrouds, at least on a frigate, which sections of the ships do they have to be in? They have to be in where a spot where there is a mast, don't they?
That's a three mast ship, isn't it?
It is a two. I believe it is middle in the back. So you're going to have an empty deck.
Either spot is fine.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I'm looking right at it. No, yeah, there is one in the front. Oh, yeah, look at that.
Yeah, it's three masts. Yeah, so here's a thing you need to be kind of like concerned about on that ship. Do you have a carpenter?
I do not. Yeah, that is one major concern is you're just having trouble.
So in either case, you know, you can repair an adjoining deck. But it is possible. Is that your other half? Is that your other half? Handing you
Yes. Yeah, she's running away.
Hey. She's tell her I said hi.
Nigel says hi.
Tell her I didn't abandon her for a fake doubles tournament.
Okay. She's already gone. She's gone.
I have a bone to pick with you about that later. So you can end up with some sort of critical hit in your front deck.
Oh, for sure. But they're also not shooting your dudes at that point.
A leak, a fire, especially if somebody's like kind of raking you or shooting you from and targeting your front deck, even though it's empty, it could still take criticals. You could still have a critical effect going on in there. And so if you don't have a Carpenter, I guess it doesn't matter. Anybody's affecting that repair. But be careful where you need some unassigned crew. Ideally, in the middle section. Because then they can affect repairs at their own section and the section adjoining them.
Which I think is just going to be the Marin's Bosk. I mean, that seems to be the most.
Well, doesn't the Marin's, doesn't that commander have like that sailing master?
He does, yeah.
Shouldn't he be on the sheets and braces?
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying is you probably want Marin's with.
Put him in the stern.
Yeah,
the Marin's in the stern. I could bust for him.
That would be.
And then put somebody else who's going to be in that middle section who can affect repairs at all three sections.
Because ultimately the decision point was, do you want to lose the strike point if you take out a guy is ultimately what it comes down to.
Right. Strike points are important.
Yeah, for sure. It definitely does come up more than you think. Mm-hmm. But
have you looked at the scenario packet?
Yeah, I have. It's control the field, encounter a wanted man. The one that's fatigue, fatigue one is.
Hey, there's some problems with that, with those scenarios.
Sure.
There are problems. Okay. Hey, I don't understand.
Escort.
I'm going to go over my list before I address what some of the issues might be with some of those scenarios. So that's your C list. You want to just give away the whole thing about your fucking land list?
Yeah, absolutely. And so, I'm not going to tell them what I'll say all the pieces, but I won't tell you the strategy, I guess is kind of the interesting thing. Yeah. So it's France. It's French. Obviously it's the French Caribbean militia, the one from No Peace Beyond the Line. And it will be – it doesn't really matter which version of it is. It doesn't matter because you only care about the movement part. You don't really care about the force organization stuff. And it comes with a seasoned French commander with cold-blooded and guerrilla commander. Two units of Milicen, 1-7, 1-6. A big old unit of Buccaneers, which is 10. And they are being upgraded to veteran. And then you have 11 Buccaneers, which are some of the funnest and experienced models I think I've ever played in my life. And it's got a local guide. Gotta love that. And it's a very movement-heavy list, for sure. It's very fast. That's all I'll say.
I'm not going to go into quite as much detail, but so I'm playing Caesar's Men for both land and sea. Caesar's Men at sea is a very tight list that I have played a lot. I have tinkered with, refined. I wrote an article about it on that was on Pigment. That article is now woefully out of date. And I'm here to tell you people, and when I say you people, I'm talking about you, Dan. I'm talking about you. I've gotten better at sailing the ship. And I have refined that list to sail that ship like a gentleman pirate and beat the F out of bigger ships sailed by, and I don't want to understate this, lesser men. Lesser men have sailed against me and have failed because that is how much I've gotten into the sailing game. So I'm very confident in that list. It is built to handle a number of possibilities and negative stuff. It is strong. It is geared towards getting the attacker. It is geared towards some sneaky nonsense. It is geared to living in the wind. It's good. It could be considered underpowered, but I will take a high skill and high efficiency over a bigger ship that is less equipped or lesser crewed. I know a lot of people like to say that, quantity is a quality all its own. But if I get my hands on your low quality garbage,
it dies.
I will take the garbage out. I'm less confident about my land list, especially after the last time I played it. But I played against a very good player who has really dialed in that list. If you have not played against South American tribes, if you have not played against a poison arrow spam list, and you think you're good at the game, you have yet to be tested. They will test you. They will test your belief system. They will test your certain assurances you have that there is a God.
Your anal sphincter.
And that he is your God. It is a different way of playing Blood and Plunder. It is a very effective way of did I lose you? No, there you're back. Okay. It's a very effective way of playing Blood and Plunder. It is a way to eliminate a unit without killing a single model.
That's true. I can see that.
It's mean. When you have a unit that started with 12 models and you lost two, but they're jumping overboard, you will then recognize, you will start to question your skill in this game. I don't want to say it's asymmetrical, but it's just a different pathway to victory that most people aren't encountering because most people aren't playing natives, and so most people aren't facing natives. And when they are facing natives, they tend to be facing natives with guns because natives are really good with guns. And bows by the natives that are really good with guns are not as effective as the bows with poison arrows, which is a whole other thing. So... But I have a wonky land list with Black Caesar's Men. I think it will surprise a lot of people. And it is designed not to be optimal, but it is designed to prove a point to people who keep trying to talk about their trash panda lists. And so we'll see what happens. And maybe they'll be right. Maybe I'll play this thing and I'll go 0-3 in the land tournament and those people will have made a point. Or... if I do really well in a land tournament, I promise to be very humble. I would not throw that in people's faces. That's not.
Sure. Right. Sure. Anyway, we've run over time, so we should wrap this up. I'm excited. I think we're going to have a great time. We'll do a post for sure just to see how our list went. We'll probably have stories to tell. I'll do some recordings while we're there and hopefully be able to push them into the episode. Maybe it might be like a two-parter kind of thing.
Like you abandoned me for that fucking doubles, by the way.
I know. You keep saying, listen, I'm not going to get into it, but I think it was Garrett, I think, was like, hey, you're in the doubles now. And I'm like, okay, I guess I am. I guess I'm here now. Okay, bye. And I'm excited. Hopefully I do well. I'm just going to enjoy playing somebody new in Blood and Plunder, I'll be honest. It's kind of what I'm excited for. Because I don't get to play.
I'll just hang out with Kara.
Kara's going to go to bed by that point. She's going to go lay down. It's going to be at 8 o'clock at night. She's going to sleep.
Okay.
Kara, if I'm telling the truth, put like the confetti headshot from Halo thing sound in here right away by here. That's how you're going to know that I know Kara best. Anyway, but so I'm excited for it. We're gonna have a great time. Come up and say hey to us for sure. I'll probably be dressed like an idiot. I'll probably look like a homeless person like I always do. And it's gonna be a great time. And let's wrap it up. So Miguel, I think we did it. I think we talked about our pre-Adepticon fun. Guys, hear me out. If you can give us some 5-star reviews, that really does help out the show. It's very important that other people hear about us when we get those reviews because it helps the algorithms and blah blah blah. And if it has words in it, it works best. But even if you just give us a like on the bigger ones, which is like Spotify and Apple and Google, I believe is also a pretty good one. Because that Google is now Microsoft. Is that who owns? I forget which one Google. Google was some sound thing, and then now it's something else or whatever. But yeah, Google's a big one too. So just make sure you check.
But if we give him a three-star review, mm-hmm. he's more inclined to comment on it.
That's potentially possible. I never get to see the reviews, which is unfortunate because I have read some of them that I look up indirectly, and they are usually pretty funny. There's pretty funny people out there that watch the show. But yeah, guys, I really do appreciate every single person that listens to the show. I do it for you guys. I absolutely have a ball doing it. I love having guests on like Miguel come on and talk about this stupid crap, and we're just going to keep doing it. So as long as I find it entertaining, we're going to keep on doing it. So thank you very much. And where can you find us? You can find me at on Discord at drddr.d. You can spell it dr.d because that's how you spell Dr. D. And you can email me at furypainting@gmail.com. If you want anybody to reach you, Miguel, where can they find you?
I really don't have a big social media presence. I do have a podcast that I've been conceptualizing. I have saved the channel on YouTube. I'll have you like promote it when it's ready to launch. But I did like this episode. Thank you for having me. Yeah. This type of banter is what I have in mind for like a podcast. So this is a good trial run to see if it works. So we'll see how many hits we get on this. If people want to see this, or they're like, please don't have that Puerto Rican guy on your show.
What a bum. You're a bum, Rock. And of course, we like to thank all the people in the background, which is Tim for running the network and Kara for helping edit it. If I'm not the one that's editing it. But if she did it, this, I appreciate it, there, Vanilla Bean. I really appreciate it. Thank you very much. And thanks for listening, Buccaneers. Make sure you always follow the Flint of Gold and keep the wind at your back. Yarhar.
Oh, gather round, you sailors bold, and hear the tale we sing of Dr. D and Scarlet Widow, who are the stormy rings. With clever hands and daring dreams, inventor of soup, held anchor's grasp. In every port, the legend grew, the tales unsurpassed.